Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up moving around from Virginia to Alabama, Detroit, Switzerland, and then back to Detroit. He earned a bachelor's and master's degrees in business administration from the University of Michigan. From 1988 to 2005, he held various executive-level positions at Oakwood Healthcare. And from 2005 to 2010, he carried Mike Duggan as he was executive vice president of the DMC. In 2010, he joined Trinity Health, and since 2020, he's been its executive vice president and COO. His name, Ben Carter. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Ben Carter, who's the executive vice president and COO of Trinity Health.
Good evening. Good afternoon.
Can we start by talking about your childhood, your mom and your dad, please?
Oh, wow. Well, my family lived in Virginia, Springfield, Virginia. My mom went over to Washington, D.C. to birth me in Washington, D.C., but we were living in Virginia, and both of my parents are from Virginia. In fact, they're both from farming families in Virginia as well. My dad worked for Burroughs Corporation. Oh, yes. So, you know, for most don't remember Burroughs anymore.
They had a building right out the window here.
The Henry Ford Health, you know, their corporate offices, yes, was the Burroughs world headquarters. And my dad worked for Burroughs. He was an adding machine salesman, door to door. And I have one of his adding machines in my office because I was the chief financial officer for a period of time. And he went door to door selling adding machines. He was a sales guy. And you know, he was promoted in Burroughs multiple times. And that's why we moved around. So I kind of got used to moving around when I was young. And, you know, Virginia, different parts of Virginia to Alabama, Huntsville, Alabama, ultimately to Detroit. We're in Detroit for about 8 months and we got transferred to Switzerland. And my dad was head of sales for the European and South Africa group of Burroughs while we were there. So from the time I was 8 to the time I was 13, I went to French speaking schools and I spoke French. So I grew up in those kind of formative years in Switzerland, speaking French and forgetting most of my English. My dad was transferred back to Detroit in 1971, and we moved to Troy, Michigan. And I went to middle school there, high school there, and kind of, you know, did the rest of my growing up there. And from that point forward, then went to the University of Michigan, and on and on. So I was used to diversity. I grew up in a very diverse world and very used to, you know, being along with and getting along with people from all backgrounds, both in terms of gender and race.
All right. From 1980 to 88, you worked for Plant Moran, Ed Parks and the crew. Talk about that chapter.
Wow. So, Ed Parks, boy, loved Ed Parks, by the way. He was such a fantastic leader. So I graduated with a degree in accounting from the University of Michigan. I had interned at Plant Moran in 79 and then went to work for them full-time in 1980. And from a professional development point of view, Plant Moran was 100% critical relative to, you know, developing me as a professional, not just in terms of accounting, doing audit work and doing financial analysis type of work and so forth, but also in terms of leadership, quite honestly. Plant Moran is an excellent organization relative to developing its people and has that reputation today. Mm-hmm. And I look back at that and am forever grateful for the development that and the investments that they made in me in doing so. But it was you know, I had a degree in accounting and I was good at math, but I wanted to do more than just audit type of work and so forth. And so while I was at Plant Moran, they moved me into the consulting division. They asked me to move into the healthcare consulting division. And that's how I kind of got introduced to healthcare, quite honestly, in 1983. I was enjoying a wonderful career there, but I also wanted to do more. So while I was there in 1985, I started my master's at the University of Michigan in their night program. And so while I was working full-time, I was also working on a master's in business administration as well, because my intent was to kind of move into more of a business management type of role rather than just staying in the accounting and auditing and consulting type of field.
From 88 to 2005, you held various executive level positions at Oakwood Healthcare. Jerry Fitzgerald, Brian Connolly, the immortal John Cuton. Talk about that chapter.
Wow. Well, you know them all, don't you? So Oakwood now is part of Corewell.
Yes.
So there's been an interesting kind of development of mergers and acquisitions and so forth. But when I was at Oakwood, and it was really under Jerry Fitzgerald, who was the CEO of Oakwood the whole time that I was there, that's where I really, really learned healthcare. I learned leadership. And Oakwood afforded me all sorts of opportunities relative to growth and development as an executive. There's a gentleman who was the number two guy for Jerry Fitzgerald. His name was Fred Barton. Fred Barton was the chief operating officer. And when Oakwood acquired the PCHA hospitals, that was Annapolis, Heritage, Seaway, Bayer Hospital, I, with Fred, moved over into the management of those as they merged into Oakwood. And, you know, to his credit, Fred just gave me all sorts of opportunities to fail, to succeed, to learn. He was the one who took me out of finance and put me in charge of like all the non-financial support areas like human resources, information technology, risk management, supply chain, and so forth. And again, just kind of allowed me to learn, to succeed, to fail, and so forth, but really was key in my development. Fred left the organization that I worked directly with Jerry, and Jerry's just a wonderful human being. I mean, I can't say enough about Jerry and his leadership and the relationship that I had with Jerry. So, of course, through Jerry, I knew Brian Connolly really well. Brian was already at Providence Hospital that time, the Sisters of Charity. But we would have gatherings and a lot of laughter, a lot of sharing stories and so forth. And, of course, then I knew John Cuton because John was the chief financial officer for Brian at Providence Hospital. And so, you know, and healthcare is a small world. Healthcare is a very small world. Ultimately, I left Oakwood, and Jerry retired from Oakwood, and Brian became the president and CEO of Oakwood. John Cuton became his chief financial officer at Oakwood. And then John would call me and blame me for everything that wasn't right, even though it had been like 10 years since I'd been there. So I had a wonderful relationship with John, with Brian, and of course to this day, you know, with Jerry.
In the healthcare field, they move around like these college athletes in the transfer portal today. We're talking to Ben Carter, and I'm Jack Pasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula. We're with Ben Carter. Ben, from 2005 to 2010, Executive Vice President of the DMC, and as such, you carried this guy named Mike Duggan.
Yeah, I would say that Mike Duggan carried me, but you know, there's a story of how Mike recruited me to the Detroit Medical Center, and it's kind of an interesting story. So Mike and I are the same age. We both graduated from the University of Michigan in 1980, and so we have, you know, so we have that in common. Kind of grew up in the same era and so forth. And one of his key lieutenants was a gentleman named Brian Amon, and Brian was a Wayne County commissioner. Ultimately, became part of the McNamara Duggan running of the county and so forth. But Brian Amon was my RA in Cousins Hall at the University of Michigan, so we had this connection. So, and Brian had, you know, connected me with Mike. And when I was at Oakwood, we acquired the Wayne County General Hospital and part from the county. So we were kind of privatizing, if you will, Wayne County General Hospital. And there were a lot of things that needed to be negotiated between Oakwood and the county. And so Mike and I sat at the same table. Mm. Against each other, by the way, doing these negotiations, but got to know each other, got to respect each other and so forth. And, you know, kind of wind forward, Governor Granholm ultimately had to bail out the Detroit Medical Center, mm-hmm. and Mike, you know, became the CEO of the Detroit Medical Center. He had been the Wayne County prosecutor. We all remember that. And so our daughters were both soccer players. So my daughter and his daughter, Carolyn, I used to see Mike every weekend on the soccer fields. So I congratulated Mike when he became CEO of the Detroit Medical Center. And, you know, and Mike would, you know, in his Mike way would come up to me and was like, you know, have you ever thought about, you know, working somewhere where it matters, where you're going to make a difference? Rather than being at this, you know, suburban place in Dearborn and making all that money, coming to the Detroit Medical Center with me, you know, this jewel in the city of Detroit and so critical to the city of Detroit. The success of the Detroit Medical Center is critical to the city of Detroit. So work that we do there, work that you would do there is meaningful work. And so that every weekend, you know, Mike would come over and he's like, well, what do you think? Yeah. And one thing led to another and led to another. And so finally, Mike had me intrigued enough where he got me to go, got me to say, yes, Mike, I am so motivated by your sales pitch now that I think it's time for me to make a change. And I said, but you got to convince Jerry Fitzgerald of that. Mm. So Mike's like, okay. So he goes and meets with Jerry and says, you know, I'd like Ben to join me at the Detroit Medical Center. And Jerry goes, you know what? You can go ahead and try to get him, but he will never leave Oakwood. Mike comes back, goes, got the green light now. And that was really kind of the beginning of the working with Mike for the 5 years at the Detroit Medical Center. It was a great experience. We had great success and really learned so much from Mike. And
what's the biggest thing you learned from him?
Well, you know, first of all, with Mike, nothing is impossible. Nothing is impossible.
You know, the name of the show is With God, Anything is Possible. Okay?
And that's exactly right. And it fits so well. So, you know, Mike is an outstanding administrator. I mean, he is very clear what his expectations are, you know, and very clear about how we measure using data and metrics to meet those expectations. But he's also a brilliant politician as well, and how to work in healthcare in an organization like the Detroit Medical Center, we depend a lot on federal, state support and so forth. So you have to be very attuned to, you know, the politics as well. And Mike was a masterful at that. So I really learned how to work, you know, not just the administrative side, but the advocacy and the political side as well. So I would say that, you know, Mike really left me with those lessons.
All right. In 2010, you leave the DMC and you join Trinity Health, which you talk about acquisitions and mergers. Talk about a little bit of the history of how these different orders of nuns have come together with Trinity Health.
Yeah.
We've only got, you know, an hour show.
Yeah, thank you for that reminder. It is an interesting how the orders of the sisters have kind of come together over time. But the way that Trinity started and came together in 2000 was the Sisters of Mercy and the Sisters of the Holy Cross that were based out of South Bend, Indiana, came together. And Sisters of Mercy were predominant in this area, and the Sisters of the Holy Cross were a little bit more spread out, but they were in South Bend, they were in Columbus, they were in Fresno, they were in Maryland. And these orders came together. Now, the orders come together because the number of nuns continues to decline. And they really realized that, you know, that they needed to begin to pass the baton to, you know, to professionals like myself, non-sisters, just because they knew that over time there are going to be less and less and less sisters to be able to run these hospital institutions. So Trinity came together that way initially in 2000, when they came together, took the name Trinity. And over time, other Catholic organizations have joined Trinity, really for the same reasons, because there weren't sisters to run the hospitals anymore, and they needed to hand off that incredible responsibility and their legacy, you know, to people like me. So we have, in fact, over the years grown. When I joined Trinity in 2010 as the chief financial officer, we were about $7.5 billion of net revenue. Today, we're $22 billion. So, and a lot of that growth has come as a result of other smaller organizations joining Trinity, including Catholic Health East in 2014, about 10 years ago.
We're talking to Ben Carter, Executive Vice President and COO of Trinity Health. Today, 121,000 colleagues, nearly 36,500 physicians and clinicians in 22 states. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Krasula. We're with Ben Carter. If you want to learn more, www.trinity-health.com. Trinity-health.org. A couple weeks ago, his daughter worked a 10-hour job, and then later that evening...
Gave birth. Amazing story. She's a tough one.
These hospitals nowadays, boy, they get you in and they get you out quick. So, all right. The nuns. What have you learned from your dealing with the nuns?
I have to say that I love working with the sisters, and they have, you know, I come from a pretty tough business orientation as the chief financial officer, as the chief operating officer, and so forth.
I think your nickname is the Hammer.
Oh, you would bring
by
that
some,
up.
By some.
That's true. That is very true. And so the nuns have taught me how to be a velvet hammer, to be a little bit of a softer hammer.
Steel and velvet,
exactly. You know, always reminding all of us, really, of the legacy, but also why we are where we are. Our mission, our commitment to those that are experiencing poverty. We used to call it the poor, the underserved, and the important mission that we provide to the communities that we're in. And we are in some very difficult communities, whether it's in Philadelphia, whether it's in Fresno, whether it's in some smaller communities and so forth. They're not affluent communities. But the sisters like to remind us that the reason that we're there is because the sister went to where there was need. And the need was in those communities. And as they've handed off the legacy to us to continue, we need to be mindful and reminded of that often. So the decision-making process that we go through is very different than what I was used to, you know, whether it was at Plant Moran, whether it was at Oakwood, whether it was at the Detroit Medical Center. And we do, when we're making difficult decisions, we do mission discernments. And a mission discernment is really bringing all stakeholders impacted by a decision. And it might be to close a service line, might be, you know, particularly coming out of COVID, some hospitals are closing, some service lines are closing, some clinics are closing. But we do a mission discernment to really understand from all stakeholders' perspective, what is the impact of a decision like that? And what are things that we can do if we move forward that to continue to meet the mission that we had in those communities that we serve? So the sisters have really imparted that on me.
Following up, talk about your core values, please, Ben.
Sure. Well, we have six core values of reverence, commitment to those who experience poverty, safety, justice, stewardship, and integrity. And, you know, what I would say is that we live those. All of our colleagues, we live those every day. And those become central when we do mission discernments and really act as the guides for us as we make sometimes really difficult decisions about, you know, where we provide services, how we provide services, how we support the communities, how we impact the communities that we serve. But we live them every day. They are not just values on a piece of paper. They are values that we embrace as colleagues of the system and demonstrate in our daily work and living.
We're talking to Ben Carter. If you want to learn more, www.trinity-health.org. 121,000 colleagues, 36,500 physicians and clinicians, 101 hospitals, 126 continuing care locations, 22 states, and 13 pieces of paper that you have to sign 86 times before they'll see you. Okay? You were named COO January 2020. You're flying high. Couple months later, Tony Fauci comes on the scene, and we hear about this thing called COVID. A short honeymoon, Ben. How'd you survive?
It was a very short honeymoon. And, you know, when Mike Slabowski, who's the CEO of Trinity, decided to appoint me into this position, I had a game plan. I had a whole game plan of the things that I was going to do. First 90 days, first 180 days, first year, second year, third year, and so forth. And, you know, no plan survives after first contact with the enemy. And that couldn't have been truer when it came to COVID. So we saw our first COVID patient on March 6th of 2020. So it was very fast after I became chief operating officer. And, you know, and we were dealing with something that we had never, at least in our lifetimes, experienced before, the pandemic, that we had to manage through. And we immediately had to set up what we call an incident command. So we, at the system office and throughout all of our ministries, we treated it like a crisis. And, when we typically set up an incident command, it's usually to address a crisis that lasts a day or two. This one lasted 4 years. So we, we're basically making decisions and acting in a crisis mode for a long period of time. And it's tough. It's really tough. It's draining. It's fatiguing. But as a leader, it was important that, that we show the strength and the resilience and the work ethic, that was necessary for all of our colleagues to really exercise every day. There was a lot of burnout. There was a lot of mental anguish. There was a lot of support needed from a mental health point of view because of the impact of COVID. But, we operated that way. I was in partnership with our chief clinical officer, with our chief medical officer, with, of course, Mike, our CEO, and so forth. We led the organization through those really, really hard 4 years, had to make really hard decisions. 40% of our revenue evaporated overnight in that first wave of COVID, because around this country, and it hit in different parts of the country at different times, so we were kind of dealing with waves of COVID. But we were forced to close clinics. People were told to stay at home. People, we had to mask and we had to, get the protective equipment to protect our colleagues and so forth, all of which were in short supply, all of which people were trying to get around the world. We look back and it was like, it's hard to believe that we were able to get through it all and come out of it, on the other side.
We're talking to Ben Carter. He's understating when he said the supplies were in short supply. There were no supplies. When we come back, we're going to ask him about the job that these nurses did that first 6 months. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR.
Jack Krasula, host of WJR's Anything Is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible.
Anything is possible.
15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohol. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Ben Carter, Executive Vice President, COO of Trinity Health, and a neighbor of our own, Ann Thomas. All right, those first 6-12 months, the job these nurses did was unbelievable throughout the country. Tell us about them.
Amazing. Healthcare heroes. And you might recall that, we had celebration for our healthcare heroes. We had flyovers, in some of the markets, I think in New York and a couple others, at night.
Ben is a pilot, so he had to get that in. We're going to talk about that a little later, the pilot. Okay, go ahead.
All right.
Go ahead.
And, I would say the nurses were heroes. Our doctors were heroes as well, because, they couldn't shelter at home. They couldn't stay at home. They needed to be where the patients were, where those that were ill were. And many times, and they watched patients die. And oftentimes, because we weren't allowed to have visitors, you know, at one point there were no visitors that were allowed. They were with patients when they passed away. Their mental resiliency, their toughness, their dedication, you know, coming in and out every day, donning on protective equipment, taking it off, donning it back on, taking it back off. Because again, we didn't know what we didn't know about this, you know, about this virus and how it spread, how to treat it. I mean, we literally, this was being discovered as we went along. And then they'd have to go home at night. And they'd have to go home at night worried about, am I bringing this virus into my house? Am I infecting my kids, my family, and so forth? You can't honor and thank the nurses and the doctors that came in every day, committed to the mission, committed to their profession, every single day, helping those that were ill, supporting those that didn't survive, and so forth. Just can't say enough. There are heroes, and they still are heroes in to me.
All right, we mentioned you're a pilot. That's one of your avocations. What's it like flying into Detroit or into Chicago on a beautiful night with all the lights on, no cloud in the sky? What's that like?
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. There, you never get tired of it. We oftentimes, I can't tell you how many pictures I have of us, you know, coming from, whether it's Florida, whether it's coming from Virginia, whether it's coming from, you know, other areas, coming back into the Detroit area as we're flying over Detroit and taking pictures of Detroit, the Detroit River. Every time you see it, it's like, oh, I got to take a picture of that. Oh, I got to take a picture of that. It is it's amazing.
And to watch that Gordie Howe Bridge being built, right?
Amazing, right. In fact, you know, the other day when we were flying back here, it's like, oh, there's the Ambassador Bridge and there's the Gordie Howe Bridge. And whoa, look at that. It's almost connected now. It's coming together. Amazing.
You've said, Ben, I quote you, running a health organization is like flying an airplane. Please.
There are so many parallels between healthcare and flying. The preparation, the training, the flight planning, the use of checklists for safety. I mean, aviation has become one of the safest industries, and we import those safety measures into healthcare now. And it is all part of the fabric of what we do. And our goal, I mentioned safety is one of our core values. We want to be the safest healthcare system in the country. So being able to practice throughout the organization the same learnings, the same techniques that we have in aviation applies absolutely into healthcare. From my perspective, though, a lot of it is also, what I do in flight planning. I'm here and I'm going there, and I have to flight my flight plan, and I have to make decisions about altitude, and I have to make decisions about direction, and I have to make decisions about navigating around unexpected weather and so forth. I have to be prepared for emergencies, could be with the airplane or otherwise. And in healthcare, we have to do exactly the same thing. So we're always kind of assessing, where are we now? Where are we going? How we want to get there? What are our contingencies? And how do we manage around those contingencies? Because we have to deliver safe, effective, and high-quality healthcare. Just like when I fly the airplane, I have to get my passengers to where we're going safely.
All right, you've been in healthcare executive-level positions for 36 years. And you've watched this tremendous consolidation. And the easy thing is to figure out the financials between the two healthcare systems, you know, and sign the paperwork. But then you got to bring these two families together who are all free agents. It's like the transfer portal, right? These doctors can go anywhere, these nurses. What's the key to bring these two disparate groups together?
It's always about culture at the end of the day. Culture trumps strategy all day
long.
Breakfast,
lunch, and dinner.
Absolutely. And it's really about the culture, and it's the cultural assimilation. And, you know, we have to demonstrate a culture that lives our values. We think that's what makes us unique, our mission, our values. And we can't, you have to live that every day, and everyone has to buy into that culture. We believe it's a culture that attracts people. So that's what brings, that's when we come together and we demonstrate and we live our mission, vision, values, and we demonstrate it through our cultures. We believe that's what draws people to us and keeps people with us, including all the clinicians, including the free agents, as you call them, the doctors.
All right. You've got a lot of connections to JR and Thomas the Neighbor. Then there's this guy, Mitch Albom. And since 2019, you've been a board member of Say Detroit. We've only got a minute. Tell us one or two stories about Mitch Albom.
Mitch is one of the most amazing human beings I've really been associated with. And I love Mitch to death. My best story is with Mitch recently is we went to the Michigan championship football game in Houston together. And I actually got to spend one-on-one personal time with Mitch flying down and coming back. And we talked about Haiti. We talked about our important work with, say, Detroit here. And you know, we just, you know, really kind of connected on a human level, which really made me admire and appreciate Mitch even more.
Well, Mitch Albom and Thomas and all of us admire what you've done for this community and now 22 states for decades. Thank you.
Thank you. Love being here. Thanks for inviting me, Jack.
Please join us again next week. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spoh.